Welcome to the Brain Science and the Law podcast for March and April 2011. This podcast is part one of a two-part talk I'm giving to the Elder Law section of the Colorado Bar Association on those gray areas, the early stages of diminished capacity. Here's a quick summary of what both of those two parts of the talk are about. So seniors rarely lose decision-making capacity suddenly. It's far more common for there to be a long period of gradual cognitive decline that ultimately results in a state in which the person can't function or make decisions well. Unfortunately, in the early stages of dementia, although the person may not lack full decisional capacity, they may be more vulnerable to exploitation or simply to making poor decisions. It's also really important to remember that there are many conditions, such as depression and medication side effects, that are temporary and that result in some cognitive decline, but which are completely reversible. So I'm discussing a bit of the science about aging and cognitive decline, and I want to focus on how one can navigate this gray area in legal cases that involve decision-making capacity. So to understand diminished capacity, it's good to know what the backdrop is. So what does aging look like in a healthy brain? There are changes in mental function that take place as all of us age. There's good news and bad news about healthy aging. So the bad news. You may find that people have slower recall of names or details. That's difficulties with retrieval. People will say that their memory is not what it used to be. But one of the questions you'll run into is, what do people mean by that? What do they mean? What does a layperson mean when they say, oh, he has memory problems? What is the lay understanding of memory problems? So obviously there's different aspects of memory. There's encoding memories, getting things stored in the first place, and then there's retrieving memories. So what you find in healthy aging, and this is the bad news, is that although there is slower recall of names, details, that's a problem only with retrieval. So the information is in there, it just may take a little bit longer to get to it. And that's a perfectly normal part of aging, and as I'm coming up on 50, I experience that myself. The good news in healthy aging is that forming new memories should be okay. So the encoding stage of memory is okay. You can still get the information in there, even if it takes you a little bit longer to get to it when you go to retrieve the memory. There's a second thing that people mean when they say, my memory isn't what it used to be, or I'm having memory problems, and that's a problem with what we call working memory, or how many things can you keep in mind at once. So we're all familiar with this as we get older. You walk into a room and you think, what did I come in here for? On the other hand, so that's the bad news. You know, it's just harder. You sort of lose those working memory things. You have a little bit less working memory capacity as you get older. On the other hand, that's because you're having all these amazing creative new thoughts when you're walking from one room to the other. Or it can also happen because you're so busy and your working memory is so overstuffed with the things you have to do that can cause problems with working memory. This is perfectly normal, healthy part of aging, or a perfectly normal part of being busy. You may have noticed that this also happens if you're sleep deprived. Even in very young people, if they're sleep deprived, their working memory is worse than it used to be. So that's a perfectly normal part of aging. Another aspect is that the part of the brain that enables you to inhibit things, to say, oops, that's not a good idea to say that, is a little slower to operate, a little less efficient, and so people may be a little less inhibited as they get older. More tendency to blurt things out. But you know what? They're older. They've earned it. It's fine. They don't have to worry so much about their social status in the world. They can just say what they think. So you're able to speak your mind. So that's the good news about that aspect of aging. Another thing that changes in perfectly normal, healthy aging is slower reaction time. Nerve impulses travel slightly more slowly, so reaction times may be a little bit longer. Now, people make a lot of this with respect to driving, but the other thing that happens is that older people are safer drivers also because they have a lot more wisdom and experience. They know not to do the stupid things that young drivers do. And so there are lots of things that can affect reaction time. There are lots of things that can affect the time you have to hit the brake in a bad situation, including tailgating and doing things that younger, less wise drivers do. So the important thing with driving is simply to look at skill and not to think that it's a function of age. The other thing that can happen in aging is that you might have increasing number of health problems. These might affect which medications the person is taking, and they might affect the person's mobility. So obviously that's not a fun part of aging, but it is perfectly normal. I mean, it's healthy aging, even though there might be more health problems. And of course, we get compensated for that by the fact that we become incredibly wise as we get older. So there's benefits as well. We don't do the dumb things we did when we were younger. So this list of things that are normal, healthy aging, these are perfectly typical. They don't mean that anything's wrong, and they should not really result in functional problems for the person. So none of these kinds of things should be used as a basis for considering a person to have diminished capacity. If they just have a little trouble retrieving things, or they're a little less inhibited, or they can't keep as many things in mind at once, that's not a reason for considering a person to have diminished capacity. One of my take-home messages for today is that if someone seems to be having some mild cognitive problems, don't jump to the assumption that it's dementia or Alzheimer's, that it's a permanent brain-based condition. At least for clients younger than, say, 80, if the cognitive problems are mild, don't necessarily assume that it's Alzheimer's. By the time you're dealing with people in their 80s, about half of them may have it. By age 85, about 50% of people at that age have Alzheimer's. So at that age, it is a good baseline assumption. Now, we've just talked about normal aging, but there are also a lot of temporary conditions that can affect cognition, particularly in the elderly. But considering these other possibilities does not mean that the person does not have the early stages of dementia. It just means that you should think about other possibilities. So one thing to keep in mind is that people with dementia often do not have insight into their own problems. So a client may say, "I'm fine, I'm not having memory problems," or, "Yes, I forget things sometimes, but who doesn't? I'm not having any trouble." You should take such self-reports with a grain of salt if there are other reasons you have for suspecting that this person may be losing capacity. The very same brain circuits that allow us to have insight into ourselves are some of the circuits that break down in Alzheimer's and frontotemporal dementia. But when you first have a client where you think, I think there's something cognitively that's going on here, one thing to ask yourself, the first question is there anything outside of healthy aging going on? So check whether it seems like these just might be ordinary cognitive changes that you would expect with age. The second question to ask is, could there be some temporary condition going on? So there are lots of things, as I said, depression, medication, side effects, we'll talk about those in some more detail, that could be going on. And as I said, trust self-reports of what the person says, but verify for all the reasons that I just talked about, with self-insight being a problem in dementia. So dementia might well be your second hypothesis once you've ruled out some other things. Let's go over a definition of dementia. And anyone who was at the Advanced Elder Law Institute back in December, I did define it in my talk there. And if you have those slides, you can get that information in a little more detail, but I'll go over it quickly here. All right, so dementia is a syndrome, which means it's a set of symptoms. It's caused by an underlying brain disease. So there is something going on in the brain. It's a syndrome that has where those symptoms have lasted more than 6 months, and where there is a decline in mental functioning from a previously higher level in memory, thinking, orientation to time and place, what's going on, decline in comprehension or calculation abilities, in learning capacity, the ability to acquire new information, maybe problems with language, word finding, more than just what's ordinary, problems with judgment, problems with emotional control, social behavior, or motivation. So about one-tenth of people who are over 65 years old in the U.S. have Alzheimer's disease, and almost a half of those who are 85 or older. Alzheimer's disease is the most common kind of dementia in the U.S., and it looks like it is in Europe also. There's another kind of dementia called vascular dementia, which is the most common in Japan and the second most common in the U.S. We need better data on a lot of other countries around the world. Some simply don't have the research infrastructure to collect good data. Vascular dementia and Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is a very particular disease process that begins in a certain part of the brain, and it begins in the area of the brain that deals with encoding new memories. So that's why memory problems and difficulties with encoding new information are one of the first things that you see in Alzheimer's disease. Then it gradually begins to spread throughout the brain, and you begin to see more and more and different kinds of cognitive problems in Alzheimer's. Vascular dementia is essentially a problem, what we call a cerebrovascular problem, which just means problems with the blood vessels in the brain. They're not healthy, so the person is prone to a series of small strokes that gradually accumulate and cause cognitive problems. In terms of the kinds of difficulties they cause, they're a little bit different. It depends somewhat on where the small strokes occur. And of course, reality being what it is and messy, lots of people have mixed kinds of dementia. So they may have more than one thing going on. They may have Alzheimer's plus vascular dementia. There's some other kinds of dementia as well. Frontal lobe dementia or frontotemporal dementia is a different disease process than Alzheimer's. It begins in the parts of the brain that handle emotions, social behavior, reward, motivation. And so you see the person really having a personality change first, and memory problems don't happen until much later. That's a quite a rare kind of dementia, but a particularly nasty one. There's also Lewy body dementia, where there are these small lumps of tissue called Lewy bodies that get spread throughout the cortex that cause cognitive problems. And a few other kinds. Parkinson's is technically classified as a dementia because it's a degenerative condition. So I just think it's good to understand that the term dementia doesn't necessarily mean Alzheimer's. And I also don't recommend using it with your clients, because the layperson's understanding, they hear dementia and they think crazy. Demented to them means crazy, whereas it literally just means a loss of mental functioning. Dementia. So the very definition of dementia, because it has to last more than 6 months, should exclude temporary conditions. However, if no medical professional has considered or tried to address something temporary, then a temporary condition could look long-lasting. It's still temporary, it's just unaddressed. So let's look at some of these temporary causes of diminished capacity that sometimes get overlooked. Okay, there are a number of temporary causes of cognitive decline, and I'll list them and then I'll talk about them in a bit more detail. So disrupted sleep is one thing, and we've probably all experienced that ourselves from time to time. Medication side effects. These are much more common than you think, and some of the big ones in elderly people are sleep medications. Sleep problems are pretty common in aging. And so a lot of seniors are on sleep medications. A lot of the benzodiazepines can have cognitive side effects. Painkillers are another one. As the body goes through those normal physical changes of aging, it hurts sometimes. You got arthritis, whatever. The person may be on painkillers, and those are notorious for affecting cognition. Some anti-epileptic drugs that are used for nerve pain also cause problems. Anticholinergic drugs that are sometimes used for bladder or irritable bowel syndrome, some heart medications. So there's lots of medications that seniors might be on that can cause problems. What we think of as emotional conditions can also cause cognitive problems. Depression, stress, anxiety. Also a condition called delirium, which is an extreme confusion that sometimes happens to elderly people when they're sick or in the hospital. Some vitamin deficiencies, particularly B vitamins, look a lot like dementia, so you have to make sure the person has good nutrition. Bladder infections are common in the elderly and can cause serious cognitive and emotional problems. In fact, any infection can, it's just that bladder infections are particularly more common. So each of these kinds of things can cause cognitive problems when there's no dementia going on whatsoever, and each of them can also interact with dementia to make dementia symptoms worse. So these temporary conditions absolutely have to be ruled out, because you cannot assume that someone has permanent cognitive problems and treat them legally as such, only to have them resolve and regain full capacity if one of these issues is dealt with. Okay, so how many older people do you know who have sleep problems? Lots and lots of them. Sleep loss itself can cause problems in cognition that essentially mimic having damage in the frontal lobes of the brain. So they cause problems with what we might call executive functioning, which is complex problem solving. It's working memory, being able to hold lots of things in mind at once, being able to prioritize what you're doing efficiently to reach a goal. And if you've ever tried to go to trial on less than enough sleep, you've seen for yourself how this can affect your own cognition. Problem sleeping can be a consistent problem over time. So how do doctors treat that? Well, they give medications. They give sleep medications like Ambien and other benzodiazepines, and those are absolutely known to have memory side effects. Trazodone is another common one that's given for sleep. I haven't heard of trazodone having these memory side effects at the same level. And I have heard that that's used quite commonly in older people. But it's something to think about. Lots of older people have joint pain, arthritis, other health conditions that cause pain, so they may be prescribed other kinds of painkillers. Oxycodone, for example, and related perhaps slightly less strong painkillers. These have cognitive side effects: memory, confusion, fogginess. Because we're here in Colorado, and because boomers are getting older, and some of them may have been longtime users who are seeking medical marijuana prescriptions, you may occasionally find an older client who's got that. And of course, we know that has cognitive side effects. Nerve pain from pinched nerves, compressed discs in the back. Sometimes that kind of nerve pain is treated with anti-epileptics like Lyrica and gabapentin. There are several studies showing that these have cognitive side effects in people who do not have epilepsy. They're often prescribed for nerve pain in people who do not have epilepsy. So particularly, these have problems with memory, specifically, so that's something to pay attention to. Anticholinergic drugs are sometimes prescribed in younger people for bladder problems or GI problems. It might be things like ditropan or, I think that's oxybutynin chloride, other drugs like that, atropine. These are not supposed to be great things to prescribe for older adults for exactly this reason, that they have cognitive and mood side effects. But does every doctor know that or pay attention to that? Not necessarily. So again, that's something to think about. Heart medications like Toprol, which is often prescribed for arrhythmia, they can have memory side effects. And arrhythmia is not uncommon over age 65. And then, of course, what about interactions between medications? So how many seniors do you know who are on at least 12 medications? A lot of them. And we have no idea how all of these things interact. So medication side effects should be a key thing to think about. Now, one of the questions that Catherine Seal asked when I was giving the talk back in February was, what happens if it's, say, an adult child who comes to you and says, mom's having memory problems, mom's having trouble, and the mom doesn't want to have any of her medical records released to you because she's afraid of being having her rights taken away and being put in a nursing home, which is, you know, a legitimate fear in a lot of cases. So I suggested that one possible thing, tack to try in talking to the mother about the medical records and trying to find out what medications mom might be on, is to point out that this is actually a way of protecting her rights, a way of finding out that, you know, a lot of things that have nothing to do with your legal decision-making capacity that might just affect your memory a little bit are things that we might need to know about, because that's going to enable us to protect your independence and your freedom. So that's an argument to try. I don't know that it would work in all cases, but it's something to think about, and it has the added advantage of being true. Okay, there are emotional conditions that can also affect mental capacity. Depression, stress, and anxiety really can look a lot like loss of mental capacity. I've actually seen this. Someone I knew who was actually having encephalitis from a liver that wasn't functioning properly. He was waiting for a liver transplant and became terribly, terribly depressed. And the encephalitis was affecting his mental capacity too, but the depression, I mean, he just wasn't able to make decisions. He was not having an easy time taking care of himself from day to day, making meals. And when the depression got treated, suddenly he was much better able to function. He wasn't at 100%, but he was much, much better able to function when the depression got treated. And I'm a psychologist. I know that depression can affect these things, and yet it still surprised me to see it and the way it played out in real life. It's like, wow, that really did look like he didn't have the cognitive capacity, but it really was something emotional that was going on. And, you know, there can be lots of reasons for depression, stress, and anxiety in older people. There's also a condition called delirium, which is just acute confusion. It often happens after surgery or a bad infection. It happens in hospitals all the time. It is temporary. It might resolve in hours. It might resolve in weeks. But it absolutely does resolve. And a good neurologist is going to know how to tell the difference between delirium and dementia. Nutrition, as I've said, is important to consider. There are some vitamin deficiencies, particularly B vitamin deficiencies, that look a lot like dementia in the way that they manifest. And so that's something else to consider. And it's, I have to say, nutrition is not something that doctors often think about. They don't always think about how diet can affect cognition. Now, I noted bladder infections because they're very common in older adults. Sometimes they don't drink enough water because they don't want to have to get up all the time in the night and go to the bathroom, and you get dehydrated, you make bladder infection more likely. So they're not uncommon in seniors. So you might have a client who's functioning fine when they first come into your office, and you see them a month later and they seem panicky or out of it, or maybe you get a call from one of their adult children saying, you know, I don't know what's happened. Mom is completely different. She's having a tantrum. Physical changes in the body can cause really significant changes in mental status. Now, it's pretty easy to clear up a bladder infection. You give antibiotics. And so you don't want to be questioning someone's testamentary capacity or their decision-making capacity when a round of antibiotics might solve the problem. So you need to make sure that that's been ruled out and that's not what's going on, particularly if there's a sudden change. That may be what it's attributable to. You talk to any occupational therapist, physical therapist, nurse. They've seen this thing happen lots and lots of time with seniors. So, are you getting the picture that some of these temporary causes of cognitive problems are actually quite common in seniors? So, I just wanted to lay out some facts here about all of these things that can affect functioning in people who have perfectly healthy brains. And we will talk about specific cases in part two. Now, once temporary conditions have been ruled out, you do consider dementia as a possibility. One of the problems with how dementia affects mental capacity is that the progress of these diseases is insidious. It chips away at cognition bit by bit. when there's something wrong with the brain, it rarely happens all at once. A stroke does. A stroke can cause a dramatic decline in capacity. A traumatic brain injury does, and that's not uncommon in seniors either. Where that might happen as a result of a fall. But in dementia, diminishing capacity is a process. It's a terrible thief of someone you love, because the person you love goes away gradually and you don't really know when to say goodbye. In that middle part where the person is beginning to lose capacity and hasn't lost it all at once, researchers coined the term mild cognitive impairment, which denotes the earliest stages of Alzheimer's or some other kind of dementia. I threw that in kind of parenthetically because really mild cognitive impairment almost always is diagnosed through memory problems, so it almost always means the early stages of Alzheimer's. Particularly if it's mild memory impairment, then it's going to be early Alzheimer's disease. So the clinical criteria for mild cognitive impairment. First, some kind of memory complaint, preferably corroborated by an informant. An informant not being someone who sneaks around in a trench coat, but, you know, a spouse, an adult child, a friend, some other family member. Some measurable objective memory impairment for that person's age and education level. So they really would need to be tested by a neurologist, psychiatrist, or neuropsychologist who can compare them to normative data for their age and education. Largely intact general cognitive function. So some cognitive functions are starting to slide, but others are preserved. Essentially preserved activities of daily living, so they're really still able to take care of themselves. So they're not full-blown dementia yet. Those are the clinical criteria for mild cognitive impairment. As you can see, they're heavily biased towards mild memory impairment. Now, mild impairment in one other area might indicate a different kind of dementia. Early frontotemporal dementia, so this very rare kind that causes problems in the parts of the brain that affect social behavior and emotions, is almost always going to be a gradual personality change. Maybe the person seems apathetic where they weren't before, or they seem to lack empathy where they didn't before. That is almost never diagnosed in the early stages. In one support group that David Arciniegas used to run, and maybe still does, but several years ago, in one group of people with frontotemporal dementia, not a single person in that group had their first diagnosis been frontotemporal dementia. They had been diagnosed with depression, midlife crisis, marital problems, bipolar disorder, all kinds of things before somebody figured out that it was frontotemporal dementia. So it's not usually people's first hypothesis when someone starts showing social and emotional changes. You think something else first. With vascular dementia, there may be some memory complaints, but it's more likely to be problems in executive functioning, working memory, more severe than usual, and problems with retrieval, but encoding should be fine. So in Alzheimer's disease, encoding new memories, they may not remember what they did over the weekend. Vascular dementia, they will, but they might need a little prompting to be able to remember it. So it's in there, it's just a lot more trouble and a lot more than in normal healthy aging to get the information out. They need hints and cues to get it out. So those are what some of the other early stages of mild cognitive impairment should look like. I should point out that alcohol-related dementia, people who have been drinking for their whole lives, often have memory problems too. Alcohol is one of the drugs that causes damage throughout the brain, which is obviously going to cause problems with a lot of cognitive processes eventually. But you will see memory problems in alcohol-related dementia. So no one at the stage of mild cognitive impairment should be adjudicated to be incompetent. Well, that doesn't mean they never are. I've seen it happen, but no one should be. But they could still be vulnerable to financial abuse or making poor decisions at this stage. So that's where what we will talk about in part two of the talk, which I will be continuing on Thursday, April 21st, at the Elder Law Section meeting in downtown Denver. And I will try to audio record that talk and the questions too, and have that be the next podcast. Thanks for listening to this Brain Science and the Law podcast. I have some articles available on my website on this topic, www.assesscompetency.com/articles.html. I would also encourage people to listen to the January-February podcast for this year, for 2011, which is about undue influence. It's a dialogue between myself and psychologist David Mirich, who has dealt with some of these cases. I think you'll find it a very interesting conversation. Thanks so much for listening to this Brain Science and the Law podcast, and check in next month. You can find these at www.assesscompetency.com/podcasts.html, which you probably know because you've already downloaded it. I will also, if it is late in 2011 by the time you are listening to this, I am also changing around my website somewhat, so you can also find, will also be able to find podcasts at www.aboutcompetency.com/podcasts.html. Thanks so much, and I will be talking to you again soon.